Hi, good morning, everybody. So it's a pleasure for me to be here and present those brand new results in front of such a great audience. Well, somebody decided I would talk about bypass transition in boundary layers, and I don't know who. But this has been already presented during the workshop by Bruno, so probably I thought I can speak about something else. So this is, as I said, brand new work, what I call turbulent bifurcations. And in the context of intermittent shear flows in, well, incompressible Newtonian flows. And the secret title is From Puffs to Stripes. So I would not have much to say on that topic without my great Japanese collaborators from Tokyo University of Science. So Takahiro, these are two Takahiros. Ishida-kun just actually defended his thesis last week, actually. So he's going to move to the Japanese Space Research Agency next month. And he was supervised also by Tsukahara-san. Okay. And well, I have to acknowledge the CNRS and GSPS, who gave us money to make mutual visits. So the questions for today, not the answers, are this. So we will deal with shear flows with linearly stable laminar base flow. So if you have linearly stable base flow for high enough Reynolds number, we know there's another state that can coexist, at least in phase space, which is something we would call turbulence. And so there's a possibility to have instantaneously laminar turbulence coexistence, but moreover, it's possible to have actually sustained regimes of laminar turbulent coexistence. And usually you find these regimes at the onset of turbulence as you increase the Reynolds numbers. Okay, so that's those states with featuring both laminar and turbulent phases. Well, this is the macroscopic description, then you have the macroscopic, yes, then you have the microscopic description, which would be description in terms of vortices, if you want to think in terms of minimal flow units. And then there is a mesoscale, which consists of localized turbulent patches. And so this is what I call here the basic blocks for coexistence regimes. And the question is, depending on the shear flow I consider, which shape can those basic blocks take? So here is one of the first examples of sustained laminar coexistence as the Taylor-Couette flow. They're operated by Coles, so it's nearly counter-rotating regimes. And they found a strange object with here some more laminar flow and here more turbulent. And what they call it, the turbulent spiral, the barber pole turbulence. Okay, so that was the historical example. The most, actually even more historical, is the one you all know. So you know the things in this intro. But, so it's the circular pipe flow. So when it's laminar, we call it Hagen-Poiseuille. So some kind of very rough bifurcation diagram is like this. So below some Reynolds number, there are metastable puffs. Far above, we have expanding slugs, like here. And the regime of sustained coexistence is the spatial temporal regime. And so here, my basic blocks are pictures are taken from numerical simulation in these recent papers, are the turbulent puffs. Okay? So this is for circular Poiseuille flow. And if you move to a very different geometry, well, we have the plane Poiseuille flow. So there are more numerical evidence than experimental so far. So these are simulations from Tsukahara. So if they started from high enough Reynolds number, still much below what is needed for Tolmie and Schisling waves to destabilize the flow, you have turbulence everywhere in large enough domains. And when you decrease the Reynolds number, suddenly you see these regimes appear with stripes. So and if you make the domain bigger, you will still see them. They're not completely an artifact of periodic boundary conditions. And as you reduce the Reynolds number, you see less and less of those stripes, and until, well, you collapse to globally stable laminar flow. Another example is Plenkwet flow. So here we have clear experimental evidence for that, so since the works of Prigent. Essentially it's the same type of bifurcation diagram, if I forget about the details. Featureless turbulence at high enough Reynolds numbers. Sustained turbulence stripes here in some finite range of Reynolds number, and laminar below. So in those plane and quasi flows, you notice that the laminar turbulence stripes have some angle with the streamwise direction. And this clearly is a robust feature, at least in these wall-bounded flows. You don't find this in boundary layer flows, for instance. So do we understand those structures? So essentially, yes, there's much more to do, but I think the overall mechanisms are well understood. So for instance, for the mechanism for puff sustenance in pipe flow, so there were different scenarios, but they're actually more or less the same. So this one is by Shimizu and Kida. So you have to assume that there is localization of turbulence. I think that's still the open question. Why is it localized? But once it's localized, you can understand why it sustains in time. So you have this turbulent patch and laminar downstream, and here you have those low speed streaks, and they create a vortex sheet here with a shear layer that is actually as an inflection point locally. So that gives rise to shear instabilities in form of roll ups, and those perturbations are advected downstream, and they will re energize the turbulent puff against its own viscous decay. So that's a kind of SSP for self-sustaining process for localized turbulence. There was another scenario by the work Bjørnhof and Cotters.
Can I ask a quick question? Sorry.
Yes.
On the previous slide. So why at the back, not at the front?
Sorry?
You talked about the shear layer, you know, at the back of this street, not at
yes.
I mean, but not at the front.
Right. Well, it turns out there are upstream. Downstream, for puffs, there's no such instabilities. For slugs in the strong front regime, investigated by Barclay et al., there are also shear instabilities at the front. But for the puff regime, they occur only at the back. So, as I said, there's a mechanism suggested by Hof et al. That essentially relies on the same idea that there's an inflection point somewhere and that keeps the puff alive. And there is also another phenomenological scenario suggested by Barclay with an analogy to excitable system. And, well, you can excite turbulence somewhere, but important is that there's a refractory zone downstream that maintains laminar flow. So that, I think, is a good direction to try to understand why there is localization in the first place. So this is for puffs. So essentially, 1D structure. Everything is 3D, of course. But, the localization properties are 1D. So now for 2D patterns, let's say. So here this is Plenkwet flow. So we also understand something. So these are from numerical simulations we did with Philip Schlatter a few years ago already. So this is here a stationary pattern. And so clearly, I mean, you can do fast Fourier transform with your eyes. There are two length scales here, the small length scale and the large one. So we can also do FFT with a computer nowadays. So here are the small scales. These are lambda x and lambda z. So x is streamwise, z is spanwise. Sorry, I use the conventional notations. And there is some weak peak here, this pre-multiplied spectrum, that corresponds to the large case. And importantly, there is a gap. a spectral gap here. So there is a scale separation. So we can separate the flow simply using conventional filtering procedures into large scales here, this is the wave number, and small scale. In practice, we use Gaussian filters. And if we plot here the large scale flow, it looks like this. So you have a flow that is actually parallel to the stripes. So what are we visualizing here? This is a large scale flow, but averaged over the whole normal direction. And that's very important. If you plot the large scale flow only at certain whole normal positions, in general, you don't get a flow that is parallel to the stripes. So here is, for instance, a PDF of the angles averaged over several snapshots. And the angle here is defined as the arctangent of the spine-wise component of the large-scale flow over the stream-wise one. And as you can see, so these are the various values of y, of the whole normal position. And the peaks do not correspond, do not match the geometric angle of 33 degrees that you just identified by computing the number of stripes and deducing a geometric angle. However, if I use the whole normal average flows in this definition of the angle, then suddenly I have a very good match. Okay. If I go a bit more into details, so where does the obliqueness come from? Well, this is just a sketch from a picture from an old paper by Lundblad and Johansson, like in 1919, and this is a side view of any turbulent spot or turbulent band or turbulent patch. And what is interesting to see is that here you have laminar turbulent, but you have regions where you have laminar close to one wall and more turbulent near the other wall. So those are called the overhang regions. So this is specific to the geometry of Plenkett flow. And in these overhead regions, clearly the flow actually wants to decelerate. So they plotted the profiles here. And you can see that here you have the straight line profile, and here you have the S-shaped profile. But in these overhang regions, you have half S profile, so to say. So clearly, there will be an increase or decrease of streamwise flow rate at these locations. Now, the streamwise flow rate is nothing but this whole normal average of here the large scale flow, so what I call U bar. Now, we have an equation for this, the continuity equation in 3D, to which you can apply large scale filtering. That's linear, it commutes, so you get the same equation. Now, if you integrate this equation from wall to wall, the dv/dy term will naturally vanish, and you get a divergence-free constraint on precisely the 2D flow U bar, W bar. Now, in the overhang regions, the streamwise flow rate changes with the distance, with the streamwise position. So du bar dx is not zero. As a consequence, there must be some w bar. So in the overhang regions, you simply by mass conservation, you generate a spanwise flow. And there is a spanwise large-scale flow, and there's a streamwise large-scale flow, so you have obliqueness. It's not enough to give you the angle, but that justifies why there is obliqueness, provided you have streamwise localization.
Yeah.
Yes?
So you get diagonally growing or obliquely growing bands in a channel.
As well, yes.
Yes. Right. It's not going to be an overhang region there.
It's a different geometry, but the idea is the same. One, suppose you go from a laminar to a turbulent region in a channel, you will have a decrease of flow rate. And it will be compensated because the flow has to go somewhere, the fluid, by a spanwise component. So it's the same idea, and I agree it's not the same symmetries. It's the same idea. And so here this is for Plenkett flow, And indeed, in black, you see these spanwise components near the overhang regions that are plotted here in gray, according to this ad hoc criterion. This is not for stripe or sustained stripe. This is for a growing spot. But you get the same picture in if you plot this for an oblique stripe.
No, I mean, I can see that, but that is another possibility. So why did you get the stripes?
So in that paper, we explain the occurrence of a stripe by considering the unsteady process of a spot growing. So we wanted to justify why this thing would start to grow obliquely. Then I think you can evoke the same process to explain why it's sustained. So essentially, you don't get a stripe. If that is not satisfied, you don't get. You have localized turbulence.
What is not satisfied?
The mass conservation, the mass budget at the interface, as well as the where else.
Yeah, but that also satisfies mass conservation. Something like that. I mean, a localized spot. So why did they all organize into something like a stripe?
So the idea is, suppose you start with you put pointwise perturbation in your flow, strong enough, of course, and you have a spot that initially does not break any symmetry. Okay, then it will grow naturally by adding up streaks near its on its side, on its tips. And what I'm trying to express here is the fact that naturally, as the spot grows, a large-scale flow will start to occur here on the sides of the spot, and that large-scale flow must be oblique, simply because, there must be a spanwise component and here in those regions that is there just to, because the flow accelerate or decelerate in the x direction, so it must be compensated by this large-scale flow, and there's a symmetry breaking.
Well, no, I mean, what breaks the symmetry? It just can go like this, get out of the way in both ways, and then do one of these spots that look like a triangle, which is...
Yeah, that's what happened at higher Reynolds number.
Yeah, that's the classic size.
Yeah. But in at higher Reynolds number, you also have elongation in the x direction. I don't have the pictures here, but if you see a spot growing, for instance, at Reynolds 400, 500 or more, it grows like a diamond shape.
Yeah.
So if you look locally, the interfaces are all oblique.
No, they don't break symmetry. I mean, the thing is, what breaks symmetry in your larger scale in the case of bands?
That's a good question. I don't really know. Okay, so that was the first part, and now I want to move on to the new results. So first, the question. Here is the bifurcation diagram for pi flow. Here is the one for plain Poisson flow, for instance. The question is, can we relate those phenomena? Here we have 1D patterns. Here we have 2D patterns with obliqueness. And could they be related? So could we make something like a homotopy? So invent a new parameter that would transform one flow into the other and back. Of course it's possible. So something that is actually interesting, because it's perhaps the easiest experimentally speaking, is to consider a rectangular dot. So if you consider a square dot, you get turbulent puffs exactly as you have in in pipe flow. But it's also a pipe, just a square one. Now, if you have an aspect ratio A, which is LZ over LY, so spanwise aspect ratio, which goes to infinity, you get a channel. That's how you realize a channel in practice. It's never infinite, it's just very wide. So those people here actually did that numerically, and they considered channels of increasing widths. So they start with a puff. So here this is a top view and this is a side view every time. So you see that it grows wider and wider. Unfortunately, what they reported Unfortunately, that's what they reported. but unfortunately for our homotopy study, they noticed that as the aspect ratio increases, the sideways, the turbulence intensity sideways, so on the sides here, is very weak. And this has something to do with the Prandtl secondary motion. Eventually, for A very big, it will be an oblique stride. But that phenomenon is actually a bit pollution for us if we want to see how a puff turns into a stride. So rather than this this obvious flow, well, here we suggest another homotopy by considering annular pipe flow. So first I will describe just the setup. So it's just a pipe inside a pipe, and there's the inner pipe has a radius Ri, or inner. The outer pipe has a radius Ro, and there's a gap D. And the flow is, of course, obviously in within the gap. So there's the parameters are, so eta is the radius ratio. So it's exactly the same definition of eta as in the Taylor-Quinn geometry, except the walls are not rotating. And there's a pressure gradient here. So we will drive the flow by a fixed pressure gradient. So the correct parameter is Reynolds-Stowe. So it's our control parameter based on the gap. So that's important. The relevant length unit, we believe, if we want to push it to the limit of plane quasi, should be the gap, of course, not the radius. So we define Reynolds-Stowe this way by defining U tau based on actually the inner and outer wall shear stress that are integrated over the whole domain. But first, would that flow by changing eta, would that map plane quasi flow into pipe flow? Not exactly, of course, because you can certainly believe that for high eta, the curvature vanishes, so you have plane quasi flow. Why not? Now, for low eta, here is the laminar base flow. Oh, and this is here. So y is actually the radius from the distance from the inner to the is the wall normal radial coordinate. Even for very low eta, see the blue lines, well, you have slip at the inner wall. So because of the presence of this inner rod, even if the inner rod is very tiny, it's still there. So it's not exactly Huygens-Poiseuille flow.
Why don't you make the inner rod move?
We could, but we have not done it. Yeah, some people have considered it. Nagata, for instance, and Deguchi have considered this. Well, then it would be called, would be a sliding quad flow. And actually, Tsukaharas, and he's also working on this. So anyway, this is the laminar base flow. So as I said, for eta, vanishing eta, this is not Huygens-Poiseuille flow. But I will try to convince you that the phenomenology of as far as laminar turbulent coexistence is concerned is by no means different. If we want to do a turbulent homotopy, we'd rather have a base flow that stays linearly stable for all etas, of course. That's the fact, at least in the regimes we're concerned with. For eta equal 1, the critical Reynolds number, here I call it REL, is exactly the one of plane Poiseuille flow. So we're safe in that limit. Now for eta going to 0, so it has been shown by Eaton in that paper that REL is actually infinite, and it diverges this way. Okay, so we've done numerical simulations of this flow for various values of eta and also various values of Reynolds-Stowe in and outside the transitional regime. where we have laminar turbulence coexistence. So first we started with moderately long pipes in order to capture this mesoscale. So this is what has been described in that zoology JFM paper. So the numerical method is just classical finite differences, and we have, as usual, actual periodicity. Of course, in the azimuthal direction, it is periodic. Okay, so these are the parameters we used, and corresponding values of Reynolds M, in case you want to compare. And then, in a second study that is unpublished yet, we considered slightly longer pipe in order to have several more puffs or stripes coexisting, slightly longer. And those are the values of eta we have used, so from 0.8 to 0.1. So first a stroll at the zoo. We start with high eta, and well, as you can see, not surprisingly, if you tune well the Reynolds number, you will find something that has a helical shape. So if you unfold the domain, it actually corresponds to oblique stripes. Okay, so helical in that geometry. Now, if we decrease, so I'm showing here, this is streamwise velocity, and here and there, there, and here, this is radial velocity isosurfaces. You would see the same anyway. And here, in white, you can see those large-scale flows that, again, are more or less parallel to the stripes, depending on where you look at them. 0.5, you see still a helix. What's interesting is that the pitch angle of the helix decreases down to values that you never observe in planar flows. Continue to decrease, we even find those interesting objects that is like a helical puff. So it's localized in the streamwise direction, still it has an obliqueness. So here the pitch angle is very low, so it's below, I think it's below 10 degrees. And you should scale it well to see that. And then as we decrease, for instance, this is 0.1, then we get localized puffs. So you know, there is an inner rod, but they're not very different from the puffs in pipe flow. Still 0.1, if I look at various values of Reynolds tau, so here decreasing, and I plot, these are space-time diagrams, the observation times are not huge, but they're good enough for us to see that, well, this is the classical special temporal intermittency kind of regime. Sometimes you get, as you decrease, only puff splittings, then you get finite lifetime for the puffs. So, I mean, the big picture is that this is really like pipe flow. Okay, so these are longer simulations, I mean, longer pipes. Okay, for 0.1, we get mainly puffs. Now we'll increase eta again. Now this is 0.2, and it gets interesting because this is the benefit of having a longer pipe. The dynamics is actually mixed. So we get objects that look like puffs and other that want to look like stripes. So we've got a coexistence of these two kind of objects. So that already tells us if we want to find something like a bifurcation, in the loose sense, it will have to be statistical. So increase 0.3, it's still mixed dynamics. You see those objects coexisting with other objects that want to look helical. And at 0.4, now it's mainly stripes. So we can have positive or negative pitch angles. And at 0.5, well, it's mainly stripes. So here, this is at Reynolds tau 56. That's the value of the Reynolds that we'll focus on a bit more. At 52 and lower, the stripes tends to have finite lengths, and it's more like break up into isolated patches. So I would like to focus more on these regimes. So not the lowest values of Reynolds, if possible. So independently of whether you have a stripe or a puff, you can still do a mass budget for the large-scale flows at the laminar turbulent interfaces, except now we have to deal with cylindrical coordinates. Not a big deal. We take, again, the divergence-free constraint, apply large-scale filter, integrate from wall to wall, and okay. Well, we should define an angle by considering the arctangent of the azimuthal large-scale flow divided by the azimuthal streamwise flow. But u theta bar can be zero. You can still define this, but maybe it's zero. Maybe it's not. And in this case, you get an angle. So focusing on the case of Reynolds tau 56, let's look at one-dimensional pre-multiplied spectrum. So here, this you have to look at this to know what this is. So these are the streamwise modulations in the streamwise for the streamwise component. So as you can see, there is always a peak at some large scales here, 50 or so gaps, for whatever the value of eta. So that just tells you that the turbulence is always localized in the streamwise direction if you focus on the streamwise component. So it means you have regions with streaks, regions without streaks. That's what it means. Now, if I do the same, but I focus on the azimuthal component now, well, there is always a peak here corresponding to small scales. But now we don't get large scales for all values of eta. We only get those large scales for eta, at least greater than 0.3, and then it becomes a solid peak, well, here, above 0.5. In particular, that tells us that for small eta, there is no large scale in the azimuthal, for the azimuthal component, which is different from this plot. Now, if I look at the premultiplied spectra in the spanwise direction, so spanwise means azimuthal, so we just wanted to write kz and not k theta. It's not nice. Now, it's a bit different because we see that the azimuthal extent depends, that's the geometry, on eta. So for small eta, it seems like there's not even enough space to have a large-scale flow. Whereas if you increase eta, suddenly you have enough space to have a large-scale flow. And it's more or less the same conclusion if you focus on the azimuthal component now. So good. So we can make that a bit more quantitative. If I here, this is just geometry. As a function of the radius ratio eta, the azimuthal length, so we have the outer length given by this and the inner length given by that. So the inner length vanishes for vanishing eta. And both increase with increasing eta. So if I consider an arbitrary, not so arbitrary, value of a scale, essentially, I want to find a cutoff between small scale and large scale. If I consider that arbitrary line, I know that below that crossing here, well, we have, confinement at both inner and outer walls. On the other end, above that point, with the crossing with the inner inner wall curve, here we have no confinement, neither at the inner nor at the outer wall. In between, we feel that there will be problem, like there is enough space, so to say, to have large scale at the outer wall, but not at the inner wall. So we guess there will be something of a competition. We can visualize that, so this for increasing eta. You see that the inner radius is growing. Well, this looks like what you would see in pipe flow. And as eta increases, so here this is the azimuthal component, you suddenly see a modulation appear. So in terms of units of d, the parameter is large enough for large scales to appear. If we again unfold those flows, we choose this cutoff to plot the large scales, Well, this is at 0.5. Clearly, you see, so here is, those are, local values of the world normal position, the radial position, and this is radially averaged. And clearly, you see again this large-scale flow parallel to the bed. Whereas, so including an azimuthal component. Whereas for 0.1, well, it's a bit hard to see any azimuthal large-scale flow anywhere, including in the radially averaged case. So I will come to statistics, and then I'm done. But these statistics are important because I said that has to be a statistical study. So here are PDFs. So here is a PDF of U theta after filtering, considering the same cutoff. This is normalized by UTO. Independent of the Reynolds number, more or less, what we see is that, okay, for small eta, so 1D patterns, clearly the distribution looks like something Gaussian. So the peak is at zero, and okay, you can measure some azimuthal components, but very weakly. And as you increase eta, well, that peak here decreases, and suddenly we see the emergence of a peak corresponding to a solid large azimuthal large-scale component. You can do the same PDF for the angle, alpha, and it's the same result. Low eta, with Gaussian, so it's essentially unidirectional large-scale flow. And as confinement is relaxed, you see the appearance of that large-scale flow. So it seems that the large-scale flow is there only because there is enough space, and that's all. So can we get to something a bit more quantitative? So this plot I got yesterday evening. I wouldn't be showing them to you if I had gone to the restaurant with you guys. Here is the statistical mode. So there's a word I didn't really know a few months ago. It's just picking the for smooth distributions, the maximum of the distribution. As you can see here, for low eta, the maximum is at zero until, well, it takes off because the other peak has taken over. This is taken from the PDF of U theta. This is taken from the PDF of alpha. So that's quite nice. So we confirm what we could see before in the visually in the PDFs. However, we cannot really interpolate. So we will only, because we have not done all values of eta, of course. So we have done 0.3, 0.4. We know that we see at 0.3, the peak is maximum peak is at 0. At 0.4, it's somewhere else. Perhaps a more clever trick, so still working on it now, is to look to, smoothen out the PDF and look near the origin, near alpha equals 0, if you consider a PDF of alpha, look at the convexity. So this fitted by least squares, and we consider the PDF should have this form, so quadratic with a alpha squared. So the convexity is encoded into this constant a that depends on eta and on Reynolds. B is zero. So if a is positive, well then it takes off. So the peak, so the maximum probability. For the angle is not at zero, somewhere else. And if A is negative, then it should go down, so the maximum is really at zero. So this is rather clean. Now you can plot the coefficient A, and now you can have negative values and positive values, so you can interpolate. So here, take, for instance, our favorite case of 56. We see that A is negative and crosses zero and then becomes positive. So it crosses zero at some value of eta that is somewhere between 0.3 and 0.4. Same for 64 and 80. Well, it's a bit different. We're still working on this. So the regimes, if I want to sum up the regimes we see, So below 0.2, we really get special temporal intermittent quasi circular pipe flow with streamwise localized puffs. For higher ETA between 0.2 and 0.4, we get the mixed distributions of straight and helical puffs coexisting. So that's the most interesting regime. Above 0.5, it's regular patterns of oblique stripes, at least far above, I mean, far enough above the onset in Reynolds numbers. And if you're very, very well above 0.5, so we have not done it, but the curvature vanishes, so then the azimuthal extent is truly giant, and then you can have this disordered pattern of oblique stripes. So just a final comment. So we can discuss this next week because Nigel will be around. Sorry?
For next week, put an N in there.
Yes. All right. Sorry. Wrote this yesterday. Golden, Feld, and Coauthors suggested that one of the crucial ingredients to understand this this intermittency as a phase transition was to consider zonal flows. So zonal is just another word for azimuthal large-scale flows. And this is for pipe flow. So we don't have data for pipe flow here. It's not too hard to generate. But we have it for low eta, where I think it's not no different. And you know, for all values of Reynolds that we considered, the PDF is just falling Gaussianly from a peak at zero. So, technically you can find those zonal flows, but they are statistically of no importance. I mean, else there would be a peak somewhere. So, we can talk about it next week. Okay, so I come to my conclusion. So I think this annual pipe flow is a nice homotopy candidate to study the puff stripe transition and the related mechanisms. Transition is of stochastic type. So as eta decreases, it was for us an interesting way to check for the validity of the planar theory and how it breaks down. And so the take-home message is stripe puff transition is linked to the increasing azimuthal confinement preventing zonal flows. And it must be, a statistical study. Okay.
Yeah, go ahead. I raised this point the first week, but see, people have changed. Let me raise it again. You said that there are no stripes in boundary layers, but that's not quite true. When you do high Reynolds number boundary layers, at the edge of the boundary layer, the outer part, there are stripes.
Yes, I saw the video, and so I heard that comment. Actually, I would like to show me those, I believe that, but I would like to see it.
Well, I mean, I want to explain it. I mean,
other questions?
Well, I have a question. Well, it's really, this is for a lot of people to comment on. So, the comment was raised, why didn't you move the inner cylinder? I think what you did is fine. Why didn't you move the inner cylinder so as to take care of that problem at the center? I think it's fine what you did, by the way. What you could have done, free slip at the inner cylinder. I'm just saying you could have.
The main idea, as you can see also in the examples I gave from the beginning of my talk, is that I wanted to stay as close as possible to something that an experimentalist could do.
Okay, so let me just pursue it there for a minute. If you had then kind of unwrapped this, what you then are going towards is something that's like kind of a half channel. And my general question is, to all the people here who do the simulations, why don't you do simulations in a half channel and save half of your numerical computation?
We've done it.
Yeah, and so, but why isn't that the standard thing to do?
Well, lower Reynolds numbers.
I mean, it's not the same thing. A real channel crosses the center line very often.
Low Reynolds numbers in particular, if you do a minimal channel simulation, you're very close to transition. You'll have very different things going on at the at the two walls. Actually, you brought this up when I was talking, that you can have things pop back and forth. Yeah. But there's a lot of asymmetry, especially in the transitional regime in general.
I'm driving a number as well. I mean, the center line is not an impermeable boundary.
Yeah, well, I understand it's not, but and you get different statistics, long-term averages and so forth.
You do get, I mean, different V-prime for sure.
Yeah, V-prime doesn't go to zero. So okay. That's stuff crossing.